from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, amid the confusion about immigration, what could happen in Massachusetts and how local officials, including Governor Baker, are reacting.
They really need to come up with a plan quickly for dealing with all of the kids and the families that have been separated over the course of the past several months.
Also today, education without the MCAS.
Massachusetts is being left behind. More and more states are recognizing the vast limitations of standardized testing and its inability to move the needle around equity in particular.
And Massachusetts medical schools join forces to teach doctors how to talk about the quality of patients' end of life.
And we are going to have to ask the question, what is the balance between prolonging life versus maintaining a high quality of life?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Amid the roiling debate over immigration, President Trump this afternoon just wrapped up a public appearance with families of those killed by people in the U.S. illegally.
These are the American citizens permanently separated from their loved ones. The word permanently being the word that you have to think about, permanently. They're not separated for a day or 2 days. They are permanently separated because they were killed by criminal illegal aliens.
This appearance by the president comes amid a week of controversy over the White House immigration policy, especially the one that allowed children to be separated from their families at the U.S. border. Earlier this week, the president did sign an executive order ending that policy. Some members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation are heading to the border this weekend. And earlier today, Senator Ed Markey spoke in East Boston about the health effects of family separations.
Many of these immigrant families are trying to escape violence, trauma, and adversity in search of a healthier, more secure life. It is unconscionable that the Trump administration is engaging in this horrific policy.
Joining us to talk about some of the local ramifications of this immigration debate is Susan Church, former chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association of New England and a partner at the Cambridge law firm DeMissi and Church. Did I say that right, Susan?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for being with us. So how is Massachusetts affected by all of this debate? We've heard about 20,000 beds are needed to deal with people who are in detention. What is happening here? How are people here reacting?
Well, certainly people here are reacting, as I would expect Massachusetts to react, which is with outrage and horror over the separation of children. What you're probably going to see in Massachusetts are, hopefully, if some of these 2,000 or more children are reunited with their parent, with their family members, you may see them reunited with cousins, aunts, uncles, brothers, family members that they already have here that their parents were originally intending to reunite with. So I would expect to see some tearful reunions at the airport. I don't expect to see an influx of beds here, only because my understanding is, and who knows, with this administration, it could change in a heartbeat, but my understanding is the beds they're looking at are in Texas and Arizona. We do have some Air Force, some military-based capability to house people. I hope that we don't do that, but if we do, I can guarantee you a lawsuit will be filed within minutes of them arriving here to get them released from custody and reunited with their family.
When you say military-based capability, remember there was a lot of talk about this under the administration of former Governor Deval Patrick when we were talking about unaccompanied minors and this influx of unaccompanied minors. And there was a lot of talk about whether it would be OTIS or where it would be. Are we talking about primarily, if it were needed, that we would look to OTIS Air Force Base on Cape Cod? We would look to Fort Devens? I mean, do we know? Are we that granular yet in sort of looking at information about what might happen here in Massachusetts?
All the reports that I have read deal with Texas and Arizona, and that's because it's difficult to transfer kids from the border. Many of these children are very small. They're already traumatized by separation from their parents. And multiple airlines have already announced they're not flying these children here. Right. They're not going to be a part of this atrocity. Hmm.
But we also are hearing a lot of the debate about the Flores Act, right?
Right.
Which only allows children to be held for 20 days in detention, right? If they're here in the country illegally. But there may be some effort on the part of the White House to change that and to allow families to be detained detained indefinitely. Now, what if that happens? I mean, there's going to be space needed, right?
So, again, the Trump administration's not quite, I think, understanding the rule of law. The Flores settlement in 2015, the government tried to amend the Flores settlement. And by the way, this has been going on since 1985, this debate. In 2015, the government tried to amend it, and the court said no. And it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit case was never appealed. They ruled that the Flores settlement stays. So they can try to amend it again. They can try to beg and plead with the courts again, but the courts have already ruled on this issue, and it never went to the Supreme Court after the most recent time it went to the Ninth. So it is the law of the land. They have to live with it. They don't want to live with it. They don't like to live with it, but it is the law of the land.
Governor Baker and state health and human services officials earlier this week said no children who were separated from their families are here in Massachusetts. Is that your understanding?
So I'm not sure that it's accurate to count that, because here's the issue. The government, the administration is saying that this was a zero tolerance policy announced maybe April or May, I think. The ACLU filed a lawsuit over these separations in February of this year. And in March, a nonprofit organization filed an affidavit saying they alone, just their organization alone, had identified 492 children. So I don't think the government knows where these children are. I don't think they know where they're living. I don't think if they've released them, they have any ability to track them. Or if they did, whether they would tell us the truth. Because the last thing the administration wants to see is 18-month-old babies handed over to people that they could have been reunited with months ago.
Hmm. So we have no idea, essentially, is what you're saying.
I think we cannot trust the administration on this.
I want to bring someone into this conversation quickly who is with the Chelsea Collaborative. Yesenia Alfaro is deputy director of the collaborative, and apparently she says a woman who's a member of the collaborative is taking care of her grandson who was separated from his mother at the border. Yesenia, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you tell us the story of what you're hearing regarding a mom, a grandmom in Chelsea who's taking care of her grandson? What's the story there?
Okay, so she came 3 weeks ago with the paperwork that it is, you know, to reunify her with her grandson, because the daughter, they both crossed the border from Honduras from Honduras to the United States. And they got caught in the border in McAllen, Texas, were separated at the moment of being in the ICE custom and at the moment of entry. So the daughter immediately reached out to her mom, who is the grandmother, and notified her of the horrific event that she was separated from her son. And so we started to try to locate with the ICE locator. He's a minor, so it was really hard to locate it.
How old is he?
He's 16.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were able to, you know, get a phone call and was able to fill out all the paperwork for the mom, for the grandmother. And at this moment, he's still without his mom. His mom's still at the detention center.
Hmm. But so what happened was the mom was able to call the grandmother here in Chelsea, and he was able to get to Chelsea, and he's here now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Has the grandmother been able to talk to the mom?
No.
Hmm. And then how about the grandmother reuniting with the grandson? What was that like? Do you know?
Well, I asked before making the phone call. So he was sent in a bus, was not like an airplane,
mm-hmm.
with all the paperwork. And she went to pick him up at South Station and then, you know, try to enroll him here into the schools. And so she's in that process right now. But he is, like, I went to their house trying to see if they can be on the radio with me. But the reality is that he couldn't even talk to me. He was just in tears, crying that he don't know what's going on and that he wants to go and save his mom. And we just keep telling him that, you know, we gotta keep fighting for this for him to reunify with the mom. But something that it was clear to me by looking the fear in him that he don't want to go back to Honduras. It's really, right now, it's really violent, violent country.
How are you, as a Chelsea Collaborative, preparing for all of this, for the potential that there might be other cases like this?
Well, we are planning to prepare similarly to what we did when the Central America influx of young children with their moms were coming. So we are getting, yesterday evening, we had a vigil right in front of the city hall. And a lot of the community, you know, came on board from different backgrounds. We were translating from Spanish to English, from English to Spanish, the solidarity among the city of Chelsea residents. It was really grateful. And it can, you know, tell us a very positive sign that we are going to be prepared to receive this family with, you know, with things like clothes. And we're going to also convene another meeting to find other support from other allies, because we work also with other organizations that does the same thing that we do, helping our immigrant community and a lot of the pro bono attorneys to sort of like fill out this paperwork that it requires legal experts, because we are good in the grassroots, but not good in, you know, like we don't touch any of the legality of the paperwork. We work with legal partners. But yes, we are getting prepared similarly to what we did with the influx of the Central America. At the same time, we are also letting our current families that are here to not be afraid, and you know, that grassroots organizations like ours are going to be there for them.
Okay. Yesenia Alfaro, who's the Deputy Director of the Chelsea Collaborative, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Susan Church, Yesenia mentioned something very important, you know, preparing for other folks who may come here. Maybe there's a family member already here, maybe folks who were detained or children, or reassuring people who are here about what all of this debate means. What's your advice to both of those groups of people in Massachusetts?
So, you know, I wish I knew how to comfort my clients, because my clients are looking at me saying, why are we being treated like this? Why are we made to feel like animals? Why are our children treated in a way that no American citizen would ever want their children treated? And many of these people, it's important to understand, they're not entering illegally. So many people are coming to the border and knocking on the door and asking for asylum. And grant rates of asylum in immigration court are anywhere from 30 to 60%. So they're asking for a legal benefit that the courts have a right to give them. And they're trying to do it the proper way. Often Customs and Border Protection won't even let them to get to the door to knock on it to prevent that. And they're still seeing their children separated. And so it's difficult to reassure our clients because the climate is so bad, but there are so many people willing to fight for them, like the Chelsea Collaborative, like all the nonprofit organizations that provide pro bono representations. You know, everybody in this state in particular, I think, has been extremely supportive of immigrants in any way they can. I mean, I think Governor Baker should think about passing the budget amendment that helps reassure immigrants that there will not be cooperation with ICE and police. I mean, there's a lot of issues there, but I really think it's important that people in this state understand that we're here for them.
All right. Susan Church, former chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association of New England and partner at the Cambridge law firm Dempsey and Church, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We want to talk about some of those other immigration issues now and how they're resonating locally with our Week in Review guests. In studio with me, Tom Kane, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Hello.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, special advisor to Parenting Journey, and chief executive of Verdant Medical, which is a medical marijuana group. Hi there.
Thank you for having me.
So we heard all of this brouhaha over immigration that we're still trying to really get a handle on, I think, because there's a lot going on here. But let's talk about some of the issues that we just mentioned with Susan, including Governor Charlie Baker. Earlier this week, there was a protest at the State House about the separation policy on the part of the White House, but also a call to the governor. We have a little sound from that protest. Let's listen.
Stand up, fight back! What do we do? Stand up, fight back! What do we do? Stand up, fight back!
So the demonstrators here at the State House were asking Governor Baker to sign this budget amendment that essentially says that Massachusetts is a sanctuary state and would limit local law enforcement's cooperation with federal immigration officials. How much of an issue do you think this is for the governor? Tom, let's start with you.
So I think it's going to end up not being a big issue for the governor. He's clearly dancing a fine line here. He's made clear he's not going to do sanctuary state. I don't think that comes back to hurt him too much in terms of the current election. I assume that's what we're talking about. The election's going to be coming up. But at the same time, and I think the reason it doesn't hurt him is because in other aspects, for example, not sending the National Guard down to be part of the border enforcement, he's made clear sort of to the left side of his flank that he supports them on that. He's steering right in the middle. I think he's probably right in terms of the political outcomes for himself.
Let's listen to a little bit of what the governor said exactly regarding the separation policy at the border.
They really need to come up with a plan quickly for dealing with all of the kids and the families that have been separated over the course of the past several months.
You know, the governor went on to say that this whole separation policy was cruel and inhumane. And as you mentioned, Tom, he said he would not be sending the Massachusetts National Guard to the border. Tito Jackson, big issue for the governor or no?
I think it has to be a big issue. And I think as Trump continues to do, to me, just simply cruel and practice literal and figurative child abuse, I believe that this is going to become more of an issue. Jamie Eldridge has led a lot in this space, really calling for the issuance of a sanctuary state. In the city of Boston, we just saw today where there is now a suit against the Boston schools right. around this issue
of giving student information to immigration officials.
Yes, mm-hmm. right. And when I was on the council, I put forward legislation to create sanctuary schools so we could be definite and sure in terms of what is actually going to happen. I think this is going to get prickly, and you never know what could happen at the White House on a day-to-day basis, because for some reason we have a president who doesn't understand simple civics, that when you run the executive branch, you can just call whoever works for you and tell them to actually stop doing what they're doing. There's no need to sign an executive order every 17 minutes for things to actually change. It just shows a fundamental misunderstanding. And just one more piece, using the Bible and misquoting the Bible. I got some scripture, Leviticus 19:33-34. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as you treat your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. That's from the remedial Sunday school candidate here, right? So when it comes down to it, we have folk who are really misquoting the tone, tenor, and spirit of what was in the Bible when it came to this specific issue.
Right, but that isn't Charlie Baker. I mean, and the question was, is Charlie Baker hurt? And the answer, I think, is going to be no.
You still think
I don't think Baker's going to be hurt in this election, particularly given the challenges he faces. I think at a national level, Tito's exactly right. You know, we've been talking a lot about the humanitarian impact of this, but there's a big political impact. The Trump administration does not reverse course on something like this that really was done to play to his base unless the political impact is really hurting them. And it's quite clear that this week was a real miscalculation on the part of the Trump administration. Maybe they just figured you'd never get video and sound out about kids screaming when they're separated from their parents. But this plainly was a miscalculation. The question now is, and they're really worried, because the question is going into the midterms, it is a disaster for the Trump administration if the Democrats gain control of either House, whether it's the House of Representatives or the Senate. It is a disaster because you will then have impeachment proceedings moving forward. I think Trump is probably figuring that right now his numbers otherwise have been improving. The economy is doing well. North Korea, he solved that according to what he told us. But, I mean, it has played out politically really well for him. This is a real problem, and that's why he moved to fix it. And Tito, to your point about the executive order, I think you're exactly right. He doesn't have to issue an executive order, but by doing so, he is trying to stanch the bloodletting that's going on.
And we are hearing today as well that he's calling for a delay in any vote on immigration legislation until after the midterm elections. That was sort of the latest that we heard today. But what about if we go to local? We hear that members of the delegation, the congressional delegation in Massachusetts, are traveling to the border. They're going to be reporting back about conditions in some of these facilities where children and detainees are being held. What do you think these visits accomplish, Tito, especially in a state like Massachusetts, where it isn't, as Susan Church told us, we're not going to see a huge influx of people. Maybe it's not a big issue. Should our delegation members be there?
I absolutely believe they can and should step forward to show the national spotlight on these issues. And as we saw Congressman Joe Kennedy step forward, there is a lot that gets done when you shine light on the misuse of our government. Now we're talking about the misuse of our military and military bases. So I think there's a real moral requirement of our leaders to go there and not simply to stay in Massachusetts, but to realize that they are part of a national body, and using their voice and their stature to shine a light on the injustice that's happening in our time. And to be silent right now is to be complicit.
Well, let's face it. If there had not been an outcry, a political outcry against the separation policies, those policies would still be in place, right? So by Democrats and also Republicans who in the all of the electeds speaking out against this has clearly had an impact. Mm. Polls that track this that show that, you know, a small minority of Americans support and a vast majority are appalled by it. That has an impact. So yes, by going down to the border, there is that positive impact. I would also tell you, however, that for the Democrats, there's a big political benefit too. I mean, I have emails pouring, you know, coming to me, fundraising off of this. So there's no question that for Democrats, this is a real opportunity and an opportunity, quite frankly, for fundraising. Mm.
And I think we should give props to the organizations that are on the ground, COSECHA, Centro Presidente, MIRA, and the myriad of organizations that are doing this work. And when people are thinking about their donation dollars, I believe that they shouldn't only think about elected officials. I believe that they should think about directing their dollars to the organizations, like, as we heard, it's the Chelsea Collaborative, that are doing this work on the ground. Connecting with people.
But what do you think all of this might or might not do? How will it affect the immigration debate in Congress, immigration legislation going forward? We're trying to reach a deal here, right? Is it going to happen? Does this make it worse or does it make it better? Tom?
Well, so the argument from the Trump people had been that actually this was a lever to try to force some action. That they've been compelled to kind of step back from that and not separate kids from their parents, that lever is gone. And I think that's exactly why you are not going to probably see action going forward in terms of any immigration bill. There's a couple of them floating out there. One's really hardcore. That's not going to get any Democratic supporters. And therefore is going to fail in the Senate, as Trump actually tweeted out. One that's more moderate might, in fact, get some support from Democratic senators and so therefore go through the process. But that's also going to be, I at this point think Trump doesn't want to choose. He can't get everything he's going to get because he was trying to use this lever and that lever's gone.
And essentially what's happened here is that Trump and Stephen Miller have created this artificial crisis, which has really using these families as pawns in this conversation. And I think today, pitting families who've lost someone, who have trauma, with families who are now being traumatized by the U.S. government's policy is not going to allow us to have this real conversation. Understand, the reason why we're here is because Congress and this White House can't get it right when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform. So that's why we're here, with liberty and justice for all. As all of these conversations happen about football players and those who were Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, mm-hmm. I think those folks should be just as offended that our flag and our Constitution are being desecrated by this administration and their actions, and in our name of the United States, in the name of the United States of America.
Let's move on here. I know we could talk about this for the entire hour, but we want to talk about a couple of other issues in the news this week, especially the grand bargain, the so-called grand bargain on Beacon Hill, right? That's the compromise bill that lawmakers approved to try to keep three questions off the November ballot. So this legislation will require paid family and medical leave for workers. It would gradually increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and it would establish a sales tax holiday every year. We have a little tape here from House Speaker Robert DeLeo, who says these changes should appease supporters of the ballot questions.
If you take a look in terms of what we did and what the ballot question does, I think that what we did fares very, very favorably with the ballot question.
And Governor Charlie Baker praised lawmakers for taking action, although he hasn't committed completely to signing this legislation just yet.
This is something we've been encouraging people to do for several months and have provided them with information when they've asked for it. And I commend them for getting here. I think this is a really important step.
So Tom, this came together quickly, this bargain. Was it a good move?
So the bargain came together, of course, after the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts struck down the so-called millionaire's tax. And if that had not happened, I suspect you would not have seen this bargain coming together.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. I mean, I think about Baker as a traditional Republican, or if he were a traditional Republican, and imagine him facing a national audience of Republicans trying to essentially defend, you know, what many of them regard as extreme left-wing policies, moving the minimum wage up to $15, mandatory family leave for a long period of time. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that would get him booed off the stage at any conservative, convention, right? And yet here he is in Massachusetts kind of facing a different dynamic, which is that these ballot questions probably would have passed.
Mm.
And from his point of view, what he's doing is taking the more palatable, even though it's unpalatable, the more palatable alternative from what he sees as an even worse outcome.
Hmm. Do you think that the ballot questions, we don't know yet, right?
We don't know if they're off.
Still could be a ballot question. We've heard from Raise Up folks who said, you know, not yet committing, not until next week. Tito, do you think that the ballot question debate's done?
Well, we will see. I want to give props to Raise Up for really forcing this conversation, for doing so much work on the ground to really create the environment to move this forward. I want to give props also to at Jonathan Cohn, C-O-H-N, on Twitter, because he actually had a really good kind of 10-step primer on this, which is a really interesting component. I don't think it's no one got all of the things that that they wanted. One, I do believe that from a fiscal perspective, having the sales tax go down and the hit that we would have taken would have been a huge issue. I think, you know, having the state of Massachusetts have paid, as Tom noted, the paid family leave package is actually better than any other paid family leave in the state in the United States. And so it is very progressive. And again, I think we have a governor, and I can't say what he's going to do, but I know what he's probably going to do, which is have to sign on to this. So I think we're in a good place. But and then I just think there's some interesting reformers who are out there, Mike Conley and Denise Provo, who kind of called out how things work in the state house, as well as Pat Jalen, who kind of was smacking the wrist of those who wanted the sales tax holiday. That amendment she tried to take it out. That amendment did not pass. But I do believe we are much better off as a state in going this direction than the direction we were going to head.
Can the state afford it, do you think? And how about the impact that we might see in terms of what might happen on the economy? What do we know about that?
So it's a really great question. What you will hear from a lot of small businesses is that $15 is basically going to drive them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think what will happen is that at a certain level, you will really start to see businesses start to think about automation replacing people. And that's going to happen. It may accelerate that somewhat. You already see, you can order through a machine at McDonald's rather than going up to a counter clerk. having said that, the economy in Massachusetts is so strong at this point that it may just not matter at all. I mean, there's a lot of studies out there show that there's some bumps when you increase the minimum wage, but in general, people stay employed and it doesn't interrupt the flow of an economy.
Hmm. Seattle, some of the other cities that have done this, as noted, it has not tanked the economy, and we're in many respects very close to full employment. Yeah. When it comes, and I was at a restaurant the other day and I had the manager say to me that there are people who there's so much employment out there, there's people who literally who have a kitchen job who find another job paying a buck more an hour and they leave mid-shift, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where we're at when it comes to this. In addition, we must note that instead of the initial 4-year phase-in of the $15 an hour, this has been extended out 5 years. Hmm. Right. So there's more time to phase this in. But I also look at what does it do for the quality of life for someone? What does it do for families? And those are and I won't call them intangibles. I think there's a several fold bottom line and that we need to think about here. In addition, we also know that $15 an hour is not a minimum, is not something that's a livable wage. There was research that just came out that says it costs $45. You need to make $45 an hour to rent a 2-bedroom in Boston. And, you know, data that shows you have to work 94.5 hours to have a 1-bedroom in Boston and make minimum wage. So there's a long way to go relative to the inequities that are out there. This is a small step forward, but a significant step forward, and we must continue to push.
Yeah. I would note that a number of major retailers are actually, like, in advance of this. So Walmart, for example, has already started to commit to going towards the $15, and I think on a schedule that is faster than called for in this particular legislation.
And there's one last piece there. It costs money to train people, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the other piece. When you let people go, that also is something that costs and needs to be looked at.
All right. Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, Special Advisor to Parenting Journey and Chief Executive of Verdant Medical. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Tom Kane, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, teaching doctors how to talk to patients and their families about death. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Much of a doctor's training involves figuring out how to help keep patients alive. But doctors also, should they, learn how to prepare patients and their families for death. The state's four medical schools are working on just that with a group known as the Massachusetts Coalition for Serious Illness. Dr. Brian Silver is vice chair of the neurology department at UMass Medical School and is among those who are training physicians about how to talk with patients about the quality of the end of life. Dr. Silver says early in his career, he learned that he needed to be better prepared for tough conversations with his patients and their loved ones.
For me, the pivotal moment was when I was a training fellow, and we had a patient who had a severe stroke. I spoke with the patient's wife and suggested that a feeding tube be placed, that he would do well, and that things would be fine. I saw them about 3 months later. He was still quite impaired, had paralysis on the right side, couldn't speak, and then his wife asked me to step outside. She expressed thanks for the care we provided, but then broke down and said, if I knew it was going to be like this, I would never have done this. Mm. And I think it was at that point that I decided we maybe should think about other ways of approaching these situations.
Right. What are some of the other ways? Because I think that it's complicated, right? I mean, what are some of the other ways that you think healthcare professionals can avoid situations like that and make sure that everyone is better prepared?
Well, I think the key things are to consider realistically what the prognosis is for someone who has, in this situation, a severe stroke, to communicate that clearly to the family without either expressing it in a dire way, or conversely, sugarcoating the information, just to explain it clearly and honestly about what things will look like, and then ask them what their values are in terms of how they would want to live, and get an understanding of who they are as a person. If they can't express it, then get that from a surrogate family member or person.
In that situation, what could have been done differently? Say you had told this man's wife, you know, it might be a long road. We might be talking about paralysis and care for a very long time. Sometimes in that moment, right, people might feel very differently than they do 3 months later when they're actually doing it every day and they realize the toll that it takes and they realize how compromised someone's life might be. How do you factor that in when you're having those conversations and making medical decisions about end-of-life care?
Well, I think some of the challenge is the uncertainty. We don't know exactly how somebody is going to be at 3 months, 6 months, or 12 months after the event. But I think we can express ranges of how we think the function will be. So in that circumstance, I could say, well, I think he may have a little bit of movement in his arm. He may be able to move his leg a little bit, so he'll be better than he is now. I think that's the range. Or he may not be any better, so it's between what he is now and maybe a little bit better in terms of movement. But it's unrealistic to expect that he'll be walking and talking clearly as if nothing had happened to him. So I think expressing a range of uncertainty is okay, but not creating an unrealistic expectation that the person is going to be normal again.
How do you think that affects the doctor-patient relationship? Because especially in a life or death situation, is I would imagine a lot of patients are looking to you as their hope, right? You're going to fix this and make it better. And so you're navigating that because obviously you want people to stay hopeful in a healthcare situation, but also preparing them for what might happen. Is it a change in the relationship, would you say?
It is a change because typically people expect that the physician or other healthcare provider is going to solve the problem, make them better. But I think as, you know, certainly as I've evolved in my career, I understand that helping people with severe illness or even end-of-life care is just part of the continuum of what we do. So learning how to do that effectively is just as important as learning how to treat somebody emergently and helping them get back to health. But much of the emphasis on what we do is all on prolonging life, maximizing outcome, which is all important. We've made fantastic gains in how we can improve the health of people with neurological disease. But with our current technologies, there's still a finite amount to what we can do. There's a limit to what medical technology can do right now.
You're working with the Massachusetts Coalition for Serious Illness to help better train med students how to do this. What does that training look like?
So it's a simulation. We have actors who are trained to present themselves as family members of someone who's had a severe stroke. We then set up the scenario such that they have to present the prognosis to the patient as the first part of the segment. We then take a few minutes to debrief afterwards. Then we go back, and then we ask them to try to get a sense from the family as to what the next steps are. In this particular circumstance, you know, it focuses on, does the person, if they could speak, wish to have a feeding tube placed? Do they wish to be at home? Do they wish to go to hospice? We just try to look at the reaction and the responses and specifically the word choices that the residents are making. Understanding how to communicate is a skill set. It doesn't seem like you're using your hands, but you're using your brain and your mouth to try to connect with somebody else.
Do you think we have a long way to go before this becomes more routine and more accepted? And if that's true, because I'm guessing you're going to say that, why is that? Do we have sort of an unrealistic view about life and death and doctors?
So you're right. That was what I was going to say. We do have a long way to go, and the piece that we're doing on the neurology side is really just a very small slice of the larger pie of this whole issue. Realistically, there's a limit to what can be provided, and as we think about the population as it gets older, we're going to see people with more health issues, and we are going to have to confront the reality of the limits of what we can provide, and really ask the question, what is the balance between prolonging life versus maintaining a high quality of life? And I think that's a very difficult question for a lot of people to confront. Sometimes they don't want to deal with it, but I think we are going to have to deal with it. It is really part of the practice of medicine that, you know, we should be asking these questions. And most of the time, those conversations don't really happen until the event occurs, and then we're sort of in that situation.
Is that a change in the practice of medicine?
Yeah, it is. I think in the past, everything was really focused on saving somebody's life, returning them to health. And those are, again, are very important things. We've made tremendous strides in healing people, getting them back to health. But we need to focus a lot more on what happens if we don't have anything else to offer. You know, what is it that we can discuss or offer to somebody? And there are things that we can do to make the end of life, I don't want to use the word pleasant, but I say just something that everybody reflects on, all the family members and the person being affected, and saying, this is the way I wanted it to happen.
Dr. Brian Silver, a neurologist at UMass Memorial Health Center and vice chair of the Department of Neurology at UMass Medical School. Dr. Silver, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we have some breaking news. After 4 days of deliberations in federal court in Boston, jurors have found former mob boss Frank Salemi and his co-defendant Paul Wiedek guilty of murder. The men were charged with killing South Boston nightclub owner Stephen DeSaro in 1993. The 84-year-old Salemi had been suspected in DeSaro's death for many years, but he wasn't charged until DeSaro's remains were dug up behind a mill in Providence, Rhode Island 2 years ago. Prosecutors say Salemi had DeSaro killed because Salemi feared that DeSaro was cooperating with authorities. We'll have more details about the guilty verdict just ahead on WBUR's All Things Considered. And stay with us. There's more ahead on Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. All this week, WBUR has been examining the landmark 1993 law that changed education in Massachusetts. After a quarter century of regular standardized testing in Massachusetts through the MCAS, the state typically comes out on top. But some say that's deceiving.
Massachusetts is being left behind. More and more states are recognizing the vast limitations of standardized testing and its inability to move the needle around equity in particular.
That's Dan French. He's the director of the Center for Collaborative Education. His group helps states experiment with new types of student assessments, moving away from the bubbles and the number two pencils. A half dozen Massachusetts communities are looking at new ways to try to gauge student performance. WBUR's Carrie Young and Max Larkin explore life beyond the MCAS in the final installment of our series.
So, Carrie, we're going to wrap up this series around a tiny, shaky table.
That sounds kind of sinister, Max. Where was said table?
This is at the Curly K-8 school in Jamaica Plain. Imagine a classroom full of fifth graders working together in teams, building scale models of 21st century buildings, classrooms, libraries, science labs. The teams have divvied up the work.
There's people who work on technology, people who are inventor something.
That's fifth grader Charlotte Groth. Charlotte says this project began with research, online and in person. Students have to write a report, and then they get down to brass tacks.
First we do a blueprint, then we do the math with that, and now we're on the model.
Oh, that's where the little table comes in.
Right on cue. So the kids have done weeks and weeks of work to get up to this point, but now the table, which is made out of felt and toothpicks, it won't stand up.
They thought about how if they stuck something through, it would stick on. But now we're having a little problem again that they're wobbly.
Their teacher, Danielle Moran, is going from table to table, helping the kids solve problems in real time.
And that little table might actually be the sign of a big change. These kids are being graded. They're still in the pilot phase, but eventually their scores will be published, just like MCAS scores. The research and writing, that's STEM, and reading comprehension. The blueprints and diagrams are math. It's a comprehensive assessment.
But for Zoe Gillespie, another student, it doesn't feel like one.
Normal classes that we learn new things, but this is like learning but with a bit of more fun into it.
Fun ends up being something of a key word here, Carrie.
So this is actually happening in a consortium of six very different school districts. Revere, Lowell, Boston, Somerville, Winchester, and Attleboro. And the idea is that this kind of exercise can show just as much, if not more, about what students are learning as a standardized test can. And after all of our focus on MCAS this week, it seems kind of like a radical idea.
This actually may be more in line with the original goals of the 93 Ed Reform bill we've been looking at all week.
The law does not call for a standardized test.
Monty Neal is an anti-standardized test crusader. He runs a national organization called Fair Test.
It calls for assessing students, it calls for competency determination in high school, and those can be done with other kinds of instruments.
Actually, the 1993 law specifically asks that students be judged by work samples, projects, portfolios, performances, as much as possible, really.
And that's the kind of thing that's happening now at the Curley School.
It raises a question, though, of how the MCAS came to loom so large in Massachusetts.
And the answer to that question depends on where you sit. Monty Neal has his pet theory.
And then there was what we referred to as a coup.
That was in 1996, when Governor William Weld appointed John Silber to chair a brand new state board of education.
Silber was a devout believer in standardized tests. And a few years later, the nation follows Massachusetts' lead with No Child Left Behind, which required standardized testing from grades 3 to grade 8.
But Massachusetts Secretary of Education Jim Pizer says that's no accident. It's because standardized tests work.
I'm not sensing any real backtracking on the basic components of standards-based reform, of ensuring high-quality standards, rigorous assessments, and accountability for results. I think that basic foundation is still present and still highly supported.
At the center of that foundation is the MCAS. It's streamlined, it's standardized, it's mostly graded by computers. These new performance-based assessments are graded by panels of teachers, and teachers, like all people, can be subjective.
But during the MCAS era, we haven't closed or even really narrowed these achievement gaps.
I'm not sure why one would choose to continue banging your head against the wall when you haven't made a dent in the wall itself.
That's Dan French again with the Center for Collaborative Education. That's the group behind some of these performance-based experiments here in Massachusetts as well as in New Hampshire.
And so far, students with disabilities have posted higher scores. Other groups, too, may do a bit better on these assessments rather than on high-stakes bubble tests.
As to why that would be, it comes back in part to the fun question. Again, Dan French.
You actually engage kids in learning in ways that excite them. You are going to reach a whole lot more students.
Kind of like the approach the teacher in Hull, Deb McCarthy, was talking about in yesterday's story. She used to have her kids do skits rather than take quizzes, partly because it was fun and partly because she thought it brought the material to life.
It's a tricky idea, though. Change the way you measure what students are learning, and you may find that they start to learn different things.
But top education officials aren't at all ready to make the switch. This project-based experiment has had to fight for state funding. And Jim Pizer emphasizes we're clearly at an early experimental stage in all of this.
I'm very interested in all these experiments to determine whether there's a reliable, valid, cost-effective way to assess student learning. But as we're experimenting with some other methods, I think we need to stick with what we know works and what we know is reliable.
So we're not moving away from the MCAS, at least not yet.
Dan French, the guy who does want to disrupt the MCAS regime, used to work for the state's Department of Education back when Ed Reform first came in. And he says he knows why today's officials are reluctant to make big changes.
They're terrified of losing their number one status. even if it means serving your kids better.
A WBUR poll released this week found evidence that, indeed, parents feel their kids could be better served, despite that number one national ranking.
54% of voters say schools need changes.
Only 21% say schools here are either functioning well or have few problems. And 17% favor a major overhaul.
But figuring out what and how to change is the challenge. And as we've seen all week, any change can bring lots of unintended consequences.
That's WBUR Edifies Carrie Young and Max Larkin. Their series is called Pass-Fail, evaluating 25 years of education reform. For a link to all the stories in the series, go to our website, radioboston.org. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.